University of Cambridge Graduate Diploma in Economics, Dr. Mark Hayes on Monetary Macroeconomics, Lecture 4, Aggregate Demand, Using ISLM to Understand Fiscal and Monetary Policy. Here is the outline of the lecture in terms of the topics we're going to cover. We'll start with theory and how fiscal and monetary policy can be represented in the ISLM model. Then we'll look at the recent experience since 2008. We'll start with a fast recap of the material we covered last time and before, and we can now introduce some interaction between fiscal and monetary policy. So this slide shows the ISLM model in all its glory. We draw it in IY space. The IS curve represents equilibrium in the goods market. LM is equilibrium in the money market. And there are the equations. The intersection is the solution to the equations and represents the system equilibrium. Thanks, Jake. Thank you. Why don't you, you can come around this side if you like, since we've got a moment. Okay, so we can use the model to analyse fiscal and monetary policy, here defined as tinkering with the values of the exogenous variables, which were those ones at the top, G, T, and M. We'll come to price expectations again. Of course, the interest rate is a monetary policy target as well as the money supply, but we'll come to that and how it fits together. Now, part of the point of the ISLM model, at least in the hands of the new consensus, is to show that the effectiveness of fiscal policy depends on monetary policy. An increase in government spending is represented by a shift in the IS curve to the right, where the size of the shift is fully multiplied by the effect of the change in autonomous spending. So that's the Keynesian cross element, if you like. However, the Keynesian cross assumes an exogenous interest rate outside the model, and in ISLM, we consider equilibrium in both goods and money markets. So the shift in IS moves us up both the IS and LM curves, and therefore the rate of interest increases. The increase in income is then less than the full multiplier would suggest. And this dilution of the multiplier is called crowding out in this context, because it's said that public spending crowds out private spending. However, an autonomous increase in private spending is just as effective in crowding out other private spending. So we just need to be a little bit careful, like, once again, to separate the economics from the ideology. All this is saying is that if autonomous spending increases from whatever source, something has to be crowded out. And we get exactly the same result from a tax cut. The IS shifts by the amount of the tax multiplier, okay, which is smaller than the spending multiplier anyway. But income still doesn't increase as much as the IS shift because of the rise in the interest rate. So we move to Y2, that's it. Great. Now, when we turn to monetary policy, the standard story shows no interaction of the sort we just described. A rise in the money supply shifts the LM curve to the right, and that causes the interest rate to fall, which increases investment, causing output and income to rise. However, fiscal and monetary policy can interact in a different way. Although G, T, and M are exogenous, policymakers themselves can move one in response to a change in the other. So it's not automatic, it's not within the model, but the policymaker can operate these things together. In particular, if the Treasury controls fiscal policy and the bank controls monetary policy, we can have the two working together or against each other. So let's consider an increase in government spending. And the Bank of England has three potential responses. So the first case is really what we've already described. Holding the money supply and the LM curve fixed means that the impact of fiscal policy is limited by the rise in the interest rate. Yeah? In the second case, the bank accommodates fiscal policy by raising the money supply and shifting the LM curve to keep the interest rate constant. Fiscal policy then has its maximum impact, just like the basic Keynesian cross. And the third case is one of conflict. The bank, perhaps, because it is independent, and if it is run by Chicago-trained ex-Bundesbankers in particular, acts to negate the effect of fiscal policy. And in this model, it can do this by contracting the money supply to raise the interest rate to such a degree that the fall in private investment offsets the rise in public spending. So this is complete crowding out by design. So this is just going over the same ground in pictures. This is the example where the money supply is constant. So this is one you've already seen, really. The LM curve doesn't shift, the IS shifts. Result is that there is an increase in income. There's also an increase in the interest rate. If instead the bank targets the interest rate, so the IS curve shifts to the right because of the increase in government spending, but the bank now increases the money supply to shift the LM curve to the right. So the result is that I1 stays where it was and income increases by the full amount as in the Keynesian cross. In the third case, we've got a situation, this was the Chicago-trained Bundesbankers. The boost to fiscal policy shifts the IS curve, but the bank reduces the money supply to shift the LM curve to the left. And that the result of that is that there is no increase in income, and there's a steep increase in interest rates. And this slide just shows the estimates of the fiscal policy multipliers given on the one hand an accommodating monetary policy and on the other a merely neutral one. So note that these aren't the actual... a merely neutral one. So note that these are not actual figures, but they are assumptions themselves within a model of a US economy. So, you know, they're not written in tablets of stone as empirical facts. But you get the message that fiscal and monetary policy need to work together in tandem to get the maximum benefit from fiscal policy. Now, government's not the only influence on the economy, of course. The contribution of the private sector to the business cycle is described by the term shocks. And as we noted in the first lecture, this use of language is significant. It's somewhat loaded. A shock denotes an unpredictable disturbance to a long-run equilibrium position, with a subtext that the private sector will return to equilibrium if market forces are allowed to operate. And furthermore, that the private sector is not itself a source of endogenous crisis, of shocks. So the shocks are always... The word shock, you know, suggests that these things are coming from the outside, like a bumpy road. And in the first lecture, I introduced demand and supply shocks, but now we can subdivide them into subdivide demand shocks into two types. The shocks to private consumption and investment are called real demand shocks and appear as shifts in the IS curve. A stock market crash might affect household consumption through the reduction in wealth. A change in either business or consumer confidence might affect investment and consumption demand. I mean, in the last few weeks, we've begun to see a return of confidence in the UK. Even though the stock market is a financial thing, these shocks are called real demand shocks because they affect the goods market equilibrium, the IS curve. Whereas LM shocks, shocks to the private demand for money, are called nominal demand shocks, and they appear as shifts in the LM curve. So these are shocks to the equilibrium of the money market, and examples of that might be a run on a bank or a switch out of long-term securities into cash at a time of great uncertainty. So now let's try and relate all this theory to what has actually happened in the UK since 2007/8. One of the best sources of a general overview of the economy is the Bank of England's inflation report, which is issued every quarter. And in fact, the November one was issued last week, although I've not had time to update the slides. And there you can see our new governor. Mark Carney, sorry, I'll just make this go full screen, it'll be better. So the first slide I want to show you is this is why. Okay, we've been talking a lot about why. This is what why actually is. It's the volume measure of GDP. Okay. And the black line in this chart, is this going to work? Can you see the laser? Oh, there it is. Is the current best estimate of the past values of Y. They're only estimates because the data keeps changing. In fact, you can see the downgrade between the May and the August figures. There was the latest, whoops, and that was the previous. So quite a big drop, actually. And the green fanned area represents the degree of confidence the bank has in this data, which you can see applies to the past as much as it does to the future. As the proverb goes, a good economist is reluctant to make predictions, especially about the future. And the 2008 crisis is all too visible here, and you'll note that output at the end of the period is still 4% below its 2008 peak. Now, this next slide, I think, is particularly helpful, and we'll take a bit of time to work through it. The first thing to note is that the vertical axis measures percentages of real GDP, or Y, and what the chart is telling us is how the main components of income change from year to year. In terms of our model, it's about C and I, which together are shown as private final domestic demand in the dark Oxford blue, except for the rather important stock building component, which is in green. And then we've got G, which is government consumption and investment, which is in the Cambridge blue. And net exports, NX, in purple, or net trade, as they call it. Okay. So adding the components of the, adding these bars together gives you the overall change in output shown by the yellow line. Now, a very important caveat in interpreting this data is that these are the so-called ex-post outcomes after the event. So they therefore already include the feedbacks between the variables. Okay? And you need to be careful about drawing conclusions about the direction of causation. For example, was the fall in private spending the cause or the consequence of the fall in output? Hard to understand that or make a judgment about the data without some theory, which is why we have to have theory. And in retrospect, 2005 looks like a pretty normal year, with growth in both private and public spending, as well as exports. 2006 saw no growth in public spending, which is quite interesting given all the rhetoric about overspending. And 2007 saw more rapid growth, including some investment in stock building. So that's the highest it reached. You may recall that the subprime problem began in the US in August 2007, although the storm didn't break until September 2008. So by the end of 2007, there was some uncertainty about the future, and the stock building here, going positive, suggests that there was some slowdown in final demand. People were starting to accumulate inventories because sales were falling off. And the full impact of subprime, can you see this, by the way? The full impact of subprime started to come through in 2008, so that's here. And remember, the crash didn't come until September, so quite late in the year. Private spending started to turn down, and firms started to run down stocks. Public spending offset this to some extent, the light blue. And note that public spending does not include transfers, such as unemployment benefits, which have their effect through private spending, so they're already accounted for. 2009 saw the real crunch. It's a similar pattern to 2008, but in spades. Public spending leaned against the wind, but the main discretionary fiscal policy measure at this time was the temporary cut in VAT. It's not clear to me how effective this was, but again, on this chart, its effect is through the private spending. So arguably, this would have been even more negative without the VAT cut. 2010 saw some recovery, partly through a bounce back in stock building, the green slug. There comes a point where you have to start producing again simply to maintain stocks, and the recovery in output makes it necessary to rebuild stocks again. So, and this is the accelerator effect, which we used to place a lot of emphasis on in Keynesian economics, and you can find a brief mention of it in Mankiw's detailed chapter on investment, which is chapter 18. It's a very important private sector automatic stabilizer, which historically tends to play a significant part in generating both the downturn and the upturn. But these days, the emphasis in the ADAS model is on the price level as the adjusting force, so as we've mentioned and as we'll see in later lectures. I think it's reasonable to interpret the stock building in 2010 as mostly an exogenous contribution to demand. Okay, because people were running out of stock, they had to start producing. Public spending increased only very slightly. I think you can just see it there. In line with the then government's plan to maintain but neither grow nor cut it until recovery had become established. And again, the net export contribution, so that's the purple there. That's interesting because it's negative. And it's negative because it's the counterpart to the recovery in output. So you've got an endogenous drawing in of imports, yeah, as output recovers. Then we move to 2011. Net exports made a positive contribution, and this time it's probably mostly exogenous, probably, as a result of the 25% devaluation of sterling, which took place in 2008, feeding through into the pattern of exports and import demand. And we'll talk about foreign trade next time. With the advent of public spending cuts, government took about 1% off output, which is not, is it visible? Where are we? 2011, isn't it? Yeah. It's not really visible. Oh, yeah, sorry, there it is. Yes, of course it is. Getting my colours mixed up. Yeah, so it took about 1% off output. And private domestic spending was flat, apart from, again, a small... Well, it's not there at all. You can't see it. Apart from a small further contribution from stock building. Okay. So the result, the net result, was a fall in the growth rate between 2010 and 2011, and this continued into 2012. In 2012, a new factor arose in the form of the euro crisis, just as you thought things were getting interesting. And again, I think we can regard the negative contribution from trade this time, which is quite large, as largely exogenous. Euros, after all, Eurozone's our biggest export market. Although there was some growth in both private and public spending, the latter due to the hasty reinstatement of some major public investment projects by the coalition government. But despite that, the growth rate of output fell towards zero in 2012. And looking behind the headline numbers, let's just see what the data has to say about the basic assumptions of our model. So this slide plots the growth rates of household income and consumption. And you can see that consumption growth is pretty well correlated with income growth, except for the period 2008 to 10, when the crash clearly hit consumption hard. And this slide is in itself prima facie reasonable evidence for the Keynesian consumption function that we've been using, although there's clearly a shift during the crisis. And the next slide throws some light on this shift, plotting the saving ratio, so that's the inverse of the average propensity to consume. So it does connect with our model, but it's a slightly different concept. Plotting it over the last 25 years. So the mean ratio, savings ratio, seems to be about 4%, but there are some important shifts. From about 1992 to 2007, there was a gradual fall in the savings ratio, which seems to have been driven by credit, with people remortgaging their houses over this period to withdraw equity as house prices rose substantially. And that took a severe knock in 2008 as mortgage lending dried up and the general gloomy state of confidence led to people drawing their horns in. So the savings ratio shot up. It's that there, isn't it? And it's gradually fallen back. And that the fall in the savings ratio may partly be a function of falling real incomes, which is what this slide shows. And this plots the increase in consumption and income in real terms over the 21 quarters from the pre-recession peak in consumption, okay, for the last three UK recessions. So the first two, which started in 1979 and 1990, show what you might expect, with consumption increasing with income over this 21-quarter period, but by slightly less, that's the marginal propensity to consume says, as we've assumed. But since 2007, while there's still this gap between the two, consumption slightly less than income, real household income has actually fallen over the period. So the contribution of private consumption has been very flat during the period 2010 to 2012. However, you may recall, if you can remember back to that slide, that there was a slight rebound in private spending in 2010 and again in 2012. And this seems to correspond to changes in investment. And this slide shows the absolute levels of new investment in houses, which is the purple line. You can see the rebound in 2010 in physical investment in both new and existing houses. Sorry, this is new investment in both by way of new houses and improvements to existing dwellings. But what this doesn't include is, it's not house purchases, it's physical investment in adding to the housing stock in some way. And you can see the rebound in 2010 and the double peak in the latter case of improvements to existing houses, which is shown by the green line. Investment also takes place in machines, factories and offices. And this slide shows how growth rates, rather than absolute levels, growth rates in business investment moved. You can see it's extremely volatile. The picture is even made even messier by the fact that there's a purple line indicating the revision in the data. But you can see clearly the rebound in 2010. And don't forget that any point below the horizontal line means that investment is falling. Okay? So, particularly bad time. Let's go back to this slide again. So the contribution of changes in G, which is the light blue, appears relatively small. Although recall that neither the tax changes nor the multiplier effects on private spending are directly visible here. Okay. The main impact of the severe downturn in 2008-09 was on private spending following the financial crisis. The recovery has been slow and erratic and smaller than the downturn, leaving us still below the pre-crisis peak. Public spending made a negative contribution on 2011, although this was reversed in 2012. Trade is largely endogenous, but in 2012, the euro crisis affected exports and made trade a causal force in its own right. And we've seen how the stock building amplifies the swings both ways. So it's amazing how much you can get out of one slide if you spend a bit of time on it. The outlook for fiscal policy under the present government is not supportive of demand, to put it mildly. This chart shows the planned tightening of fiscal policy since 2010, which was the election, relative to 2008, which was, of course, the date of the crisis. So points to note, this is the planned change in fiscal policy, which is different from the actual level of the contribution from fiscal policy, planned, not actual. And in particular, the government deficit, G minus T, in terms of the model, will have been constant at 120 billion for the last 3 years. So this slide assumed that the deficit would be closed over that period because of the cuts in public spending. This is what actually happened. So the light white budget March 2010 was Labour's budget. Autumn statement 2010 was the coalition's first. That's this one here. First budget, effectively, autumn statement. So they saw the deficit coming down pretty sharpish. The 2012 one was there. The 2013 one is there. So basically, if you actually look at what the deficit was between 2012 and 2014, it's the same, 120 billion. This is what it was supposed to be. but it was flat, despite the cuts in public spending. But I mean, just going back to this previous slide for a moment, you can see that the coalition plan is to eliminate the deficit mainly by cutting spending, with a total tightening of fiscal policy of nearly 10 percentage points, that's the on the vertical scale there, relative to 2008 over the decade. And by contrast, the previous government was giving a mild stimulus during the first 2 years after the crisis. Plans are not the same as outcomes, as we've just seen looking at the green slide, and you should already be able to see why this might be from what we've learned. The biggest problem is that, yes, government can directly control its own spending, but tax revenue and benefits, spending, depend on the level of income. So if the spending cuts reduce income, it's quite possible that the cuts do not reduce the deficit, i.e. the difference between public spending and revenue. Indeed, if you... Well, we've done it. If you compare the planned reduction in the deficit in the autumn 2010 statement with the subsequent outcomes and the detailed or updated plans, you know, it's very clear. How was the strategy supposed to work? This was the original strategy in 2010, summarized in two bars, in terms of the sources of demand and national income per worker. Now, this is not quite the same as national income per worker, because what's missing is imports. So this represents the autonomous sources of demand together with private consumption. The figures are expressed in pounds per available worker, of which there were 32 million. Well, there are about 32 million. And between 2010 and 2015, the coalition planned to cut spending on public services by £1,200 per head in real terms. So about 12%. And that excludes social security payments, which are transfers, as we mentioned earlier, and therefore they net out when we look at the economy as a whole. And as you know, there's a lot of pressure on benefits at the moment. Private consumption was supposed to increase by £2,300 over the 5 years per head, about 8% up. And that assumed, that was based on the assumption that total income would increase by 14%, partly through, obviously, a reduction in unemployment. But the primary drivers of the recovery were to be first exports, which were to grow by £3,600 per head, but that's 31%, meaning export growth twice as fast as imports, to produce the most favourable balance of trade or net exports since 1983. So this was an optimistic assumption. And secondly, investment, mostly by the private sector, since, as you will have noticed, public investment was being cut, the combined total was to rise by £2,800 per head, which is a 41% increase, which would make it the highest level of national income invested at any time so far this 21st century. And there were one or two of us who did write to the FT and things like that just before the election, pointing this out. But we haven't wasted our breath since. You can see that the size of investment, export and public demand is relatively small relative to the private consumption, which of course is the big blue bar. But those investment, exports and public spending are the main drivers of the changes in income and therefore of private consumption because of the spending multiplier, which you now know all about. This slide shows the current projected increase in government debt per worker between 2010 and what it would have been under Labour's plans, together with the extra debt that the coalition strategy has so far created on its present plans. So under the coalition, debt is now projected to be £43,000 per head in 2015 instead of £35,000. Interesting. And these are big numbers. If you imagine yourself, well, I suppose you're all students, you've got huge student debts, haven't you? But, these are big numbers, but you do have to put them in perspective. So that's the top here is the same as the ones, the debts we were just looking at. But for, let me get this right. So if we look at the other forms of debt, so government debt is the top slice, personal debt is the next, maybe student loans. Corporate debt is the next chunk, and of course banks are the biggest. The point about this, I mean, this is a total of £350,000 per head of the working population of this country. We all owe £250,000. But it's not quite as simple as that. It depends, I mean, whether debt is good or bad depends on how it's used. And it can be simply the counterpart to wealth. What I mean by that, if you look at most of the personal debt, for instance, that's mostly house mortgages. So there's some value on the other side of the debt. A corporate debt is matched by physical assets, such as machinery and goods. The bank debt is what we call money. In other words, deposits in banks. So despite all the trouble with the banks, bank deposits are matched by assets, including many overseas. So the implication here is that debt in itself is a tool. I used to be a banker, as I mentioned earlier. The crucial question is whether you can trust the people borrowing the money and perhaps lending it to use it wisely. So here's a very long view. Since the mid-19th century. And I'm afraid I've lost the vertical scale on this slide, but they're basically 50% bars. And you can see that the one thing governments are always allowed to borrow money for is wars. And it peaked for the UK at 250% in 1946. But the interesting thing about this slide is that is how steeply it came down after the Second World War. Partly it was a matter of inflation. There was some inflation. But the main reason, particularly in the earlier part, was economic growth. This is an interesting slide, which you won't find in textbooks. This shows a negative relationship between changes in the debt burden and then the growth of public spending. A negative relationship, that's public spending excluding transfers again, over the last 100 years. Oops, sorry. Yeah. In other words, cuts in public spending increase the debt burden. And I've shown you that that's already happened over the last 2 years. More spending cuts the debt burden. Wow. How can that be? And the reason is, go back to our model. Public services and investment, and we are talking about spending, not transfers, create jobs, income, and taxes. As Mr. Keynes put it, look after the unemployment and the debt will look after itself. And what matters is the debt burden or ratio. That's the ratio of debt to income, not the absolute amount of debt, provided, that it is wisely invested. So in terms of fiscal policy and the whole debate, the answer to debt may indeed, to some extent, be more debt. But it must take the right form. Indeed, you know, why else is the coalition trying so hard to make the banks lend to small businesses? In other words, the strategy is to make those businesses more indebted to the banks. So debt can't be an altogether bad thing. Nevertheless, any opposition party has a difficult political and rhetorical challenge at the next election. The coalition is right that a sustained UK recovery must be based on either investment or exports. However, with the banks trashed and the Eurozone in stagnation, sustainable recovery may require more public investment, funded by an increase in public debt in absolute terms. I say may, because we shall see what happens. But that's what's hard to sell to voters, especially when the present government have made the so-called debt crisis a cover for their real agenda, which is to cut back the state. It does not seem to make it easier, politically, that under the coalition strategy, the government debt is actually rising rapidly in absolute terms anyway. Tad political, you might be saying, but that's the point of economics to some extent, is to give us tools to analyse these really very important issues that affect, you know, millions of people's lives. And we certainly, I hope, now have put some flesh on the bones of our model. Hopefully you've now got a... Well, there's one more slide I just want to show you. This is unemployment adjusted for underemployment and in two forms. This is part-time workers who want a full-time job and temporary workers who want a full-time job. The publicity has focused on this bottom figure, but it's interesting that if you factor this in, this recession has been nearly as bad as the 1991 in terms of employment. But anyway, hopefully you've now got a better feel for the meaning of C, I, G, N, X and G minus T. So they're no longer just mathematical symbols. We've looked at some of the data on real demand shocks and fiscal policy. Okay, so let's now look at nominal demand shocks and monetary policy. In the terms of the model, what lies behind MS, MD and I? Unfortunately, we can't directly observe MD, the demand for money. All we know is that it must be equal to the money supply. So let's begin with I. Our textbook places the emphasis on the short-term policy rate, which is under the direct control of the central bank, because it controls the supply of liquidity to the commercial banking sector, and indeed it now once again regulates the sector. And, well, yes, the short-term policy rate, that does raise an interesting question as to what is the relevant rate of interest for investment, big I. Is it the short-term policy rate, or is it a longer-term rate corresponding to the life of a physical investment? Okay. What do you have to pay to borrow money for 10 years if you're buying a 10-year life asset? And this slide shows the path of monetary policy since 2008. Sorry, this one does. That's the monetary policy. I'll come back to this one in a minute. The Bank of England dropped the rates to 0.5%, which is its effective minimum for technical reasons, as soon as the crisis broke, and it stayed on the floor ever since. Markets have been expecting it to be raised, as shown by the coloured curves, those little upturns. But the point at which this upturn takes place has been continually receding. Indeed, the new governor, Mark Carney, has introduced the concept of forward guidance, you may have heard of, which means that subject to several caveats and knockouts, the rate will not rise until unemployment falls below 7%. And currently it's 7.7. But that's the policy rate. So basically, the foot is flat on the floor. Here's the longer rate, measured by the yield on 10-year government bonds. It's not so easy to control, but it has fallen gradually. This is the UK rate, has fallen gradually in line with US and German bond yields. And part of the reason for this may well be the impact of so-called quantitative easing, which is the creation of money by the Bank of England through the purchase of government bonds, and in theory other securities, from financial institutions other than banks. The mechanism by which this may work is not well understood. You can watch a video on the Bank of England website, which I won't show you today, which tries to explain it. Now, the way to understand, where does QE fit into this? Okay. I suggest that the best way to understand it is first to remember that the banks are still in deep shock after 2008, and they're in various degrees of dysfunction. The second thing you need to know is that the main way in which the money supply changes is through changes in bank lending. Okay. When a bank lends money or buys an asset, it pays with an IOU, a deposit with itself, and that's new money. This slide shows the absolute size of the UK money supply since 2008. Despite the best efforts of the Bank of England, the money supply has been in danger of shrinking over this period. The total of, and this is ex post, right? This is after the effects of quantitative easing. The total of 6.5 trillion compares with 375 billion of additional central bank money created by QE, which is only a little more than 5% of the total money supply. So all these guys who were worried that we're about to have a hyperinflation because of QE haven't looked at this slide. And this is another way of looking at it. This is the Bank of England's chart. This shows the changes in money supply and money income. So that's M from our model, and PY, nominal GDP, P times Y, shows it in a bit more detail. You can see that before the crisis, money supply growth was on average a bit higher than money income. And in the terms of the quantity theory, which we haven't really talked about, but you can read about in the books, velocity was falling, as it has been for many years, and, you know, anything but stable. But since 2010, the money supply has tended to grow more slowly than money income, which means there's less liquidity in the economy at a time when, if anything, households and non-banks have wanted to become more liquid. In other words, hold more money in their investment portfolios. And ironically, the lack of liquidity partly reflects a repayment of previous debts by households and companies and a reluctance to incur new debts. Debt repayment reduces bank deposits and contracts the money supply. So where does the central bank money go that's created by QE? It goes into the banks. The Bank of England creates money, like any other bank, by lending money or buying assets. And this chart shows the composition of the bank's assets up until 2009. The relevant parts of the chart are in the light blue and the green. The light blue represents something called sterling reverse repos, which is a fancy name for lending to the commercial banks against the collateral of government bonds. And after Lehman collapsed in 2008, the banks lending to the commercial banks exploded, that's the blue section, in the scramble for liquidity. And the second phase, which is called the asset purchase facility, and that's the green bit, the banks switched from lending money directly to the commercial banks and instead started to buy government securities from the non-bank financial institutions and corporates. And I suspect that's partly, though they don't say this, because it reduces the exposure of the central bank to the risk of commercial bank default. So think of that slide there for a moment, and now look at this one. The asset purchase facility expanded enormously. The previous slide is just a little bit on the left. And it did so particularly at the beginning of 2012, which is when it ramps up, when there was a combination of continuing falling growth in the UK and the imposition for the first time in the euro crisis of haircuts on bank lending, which absolutely terrified the banks. So this took the bank's balance sheet up to 400 billion, most of which represents quantitative easing. That's the asset side of the balance sheet. I don't know how many of you know any accounting, but there you go. That's the asset side. For every asset, there must be a liability. The light blue is reserve balances, that is, deposits at the Bank of England held by the commercial banks. So that's the high-powered money. Note that the growth of the currency in the banknotes, which is what people usually think of about printing money, has been stable because basically it's unaffected by QE and it's not important. So to answer the question that we put us to ourselves, the money created by QE has gone into the commercial banks and not directly added to the overall money supply. And the overall money supply is mainly the deposits of the commercial banks themselves. QE is not really about increasing the money supply, it's about stopping the commercial banks shrinking it. And from this perspective, you can understand better why the government's put so much emphasis on various schemes to encourage bank lending, preferably for business, but now increasingly it seems for property, even at the risk of reigniting the same problem that we had before, which was a property bubble. But the reason for this seems to be that the policymakers are absolutely terrified of deflation. Any fall in the general price level, because of the consequences for private households with negative equity in housing, and the risk of a general collapse in the banking system, which is already severely undercapitalised. Dare Turner, who was also a Cambridge economist and used to be in charge of the FSA, says the capital ratio should be something like 20%, not 8. He used to regulate the banks. Now this is all quite a long way from the ISLM diagram, but let's be clear how they connect. The textbook suggests that the money supply is simply fixed by the central bank and can be adjusted in order to target the short-term policy rate. That is quite true, but it's a very small part of the overall picture. Most of the action since 2008 has been an at times fairly desperate effort by central banks, not only in the UK, to stop the money supply shrinking and maintain the liquidity of the private sector. Holding the policy rate to the floor has been the easy bit. Measured by the impact on the long rate, UK monetary policy has actually been relatively successful. Much of this has to do with the fact that sterling is an independent currency, and if you look at the other lines on the chart, other large economies, including Spain and Italy, have been much less successful because of the constraints of the euro. And we'll talk about that a bit later. So, I strongly recommend reading beyond the textbook. And in particular, looking at the websites of the Institute for Fiscal Studies, the Office for Budget Responsibility, the Treasury's budget website, and, of course, National Statistics. You should try and immerse yourself in statistics. Economists used to be accused of being blue book fiends. They would spend all their time looking at numbers. You should do this, because then you have some idea of what all these squiggles actually represent. So what we've done, ISLM is a way of dealing with the interaction of fiscal and monetary policy. It raises the possibility in theory of crowding out, though we haven't seen much evidence of that in practice. The monetary policy response since 2008 has been to put the pedal flat to the floor and to introduce unconventional monetary policy in the form of quantitative easing. Fiscal policy switched. It's gone from being mildly supportive immediately after the crisis to severely contractionary since 2010. And the result, I think I can say that, the result has been that output has stagnated until recently, and it's still several percentage points below 2008. So next time what we'll do is extend this model from the domestic economy to take account of foreign trade and the exchange rate.